Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page with USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane will be back tomorrow. Jonathan Balcom, an animal behavior research scientist, dedicates his new book to hyenas, spiders, bats, snakes, whip scorpions, and all the other beings deemed foul and loathsome. He offers a look inside the lives of animals, big and small, to show how they communicate, solve problems, and sometimes even feel emotions. The book is titled Second Nature, and Jonathan Balcom joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation in just a bit. Our toll-free number is 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. And if you have a minute, you can look at our newly designed website. The new design just went up yesterday. It's www.drshow.org. So one of the interesting things in your book, Second Nature, the vocabulary of prairie dogs. Tell us about prairie dogs and how they communicate.
There's a guy named Khan Slabodchikov who's at Northern Arizona University, and he's been studying these animals for 20-plus years. And it turns out these are highly social animals. And whenever you have a social species, you tend to have pretty complex communication because they need to talk to each other. And prairie dogs, they're a rodent, medium-sized, and they do have the misfortune of having a lot of enemies. And so they've evolved a very sophisticated alarm-calling system. And they have different calls, not only different calls, a vocabulary of different calls, but also a pretty rich vocabulary of modifiers to those calls. So they have a distinctive call for, say, a coyote. They have a distinctive call for a hawk or an eagle. Hawk and eagle is just about the most dangerous threat because they can come out of nowhere very quickly. And so if that call is made, and this is studied by doing playback experiments where the guy records the call and plays them back without the predator being there, and you see that the animals respond appropriately. If an eagle's coming, the coyotes just dash from wherever they are to the nearest burrow and get down and get out of the way. If it's a coyote, they dash to the burrow and wait at the entrance, looking carefully. If it's a dog, well, dogs are a little slower than coyotes, and they're a little more predictable, and so they would just stand alert and keep an eye out. If it's a human, they may treat a human like an eagle, especially if they've been seen carrying a gun. Interestingly, this research team found that the animals respond differently if the human is actually armed. And if they have a special modifier for the call. And if you look at the recent history of prairie dogs, their populations have decreased by about 98% through habitat destruction and persecution by hunting and shooting. So it's not surprising that they are very, very tuned into people armed with guns.
So a prairie dog who sees a human with a gun makes a sound, a call to other prairie dogs that says, "I'm seeing a human with a gun."
Yes, and that's an interesting aspect of alarm calling, which, by the way, is quite widespread in nature, is it's a bit of a sacrifice to the individual, because when you make an alarm call, be you a bird or a prairie dog, you're drawing attention to yourself. So it's a rather selfless thing to do. And again, it's a function of living in a society. It's sort of a form of benevolence, if you like. And I spend quite some time in my book talking about goodness in nature and how nature is commonly portrayed in negative terms and as a very violent, harsh, and earnest place, when in fact there's a lot of goodness. They make these calls, and so the individual incurs something of a cost. And then everyone hears that call and they recognize it. And by the way, the first studies coming out on this were back in the 60s with vervet monkeys in Africa. They, too, have a vocabulary of alarm signals, and they have calls, for instance, for eagle, because some large eagles will prey on vervet monkeys, and if they hear the eagle call, they go to the base of the tree, which is where eagles aren't likely to attack them. If they hear a leopard call, a call for the leopard, they go to the outer branches of a tree. And so you can see it's pretty important to interpret those calls correctly, because if you think you heard leopard call and it was actually an eagle call and you go to the outer branches of a tree, you're asking for trouble.
So is this only for predators, or do animals like these communicate to have for other things like, hey, I'm lonely, come over tonight?
Sure, absolutely. There's plenty of other calls in the vocabulary. I used to study bats, and bats are what's known about bats by the general public is not a great deal usually, but they have a lot of echolocation calls, which is sort of self-communication, but they also have a rich vocabulary when they're out, when they're in their caves or in their roosts talking to each other. But let me pick another example of an animal that has a rich vocabulary that is social, and that's the chicken, the lowly chicken, often dismissed as a small-brained animal. But these animals are highly sophisticated. They show restraint, they show noble behavior, and they have a quite a versatile, diverse vocabulary. One example is the come hither call or the food call issued by roosters. And studies show that roosters will not make this call unless a hen is nearby. And if he finds something in the grass, a grasshopper or a cricket, he will make this call. It's a very distinctive call. And the hen recognizes the call. She comes running, and the rooster behaves very gallantly. He sort of points out the morsel, and the hen will, if she finds it, she'll chow down. And, of course, she'll remember the reward, the favor, and may reward that behavior next week. And if you're cynical enough, you'll probably know why she might do what he might do.
When talking about chickens, you write about a group of chickens that could actually choose among different photos of humans. Tell us about that study.
That study was really what got me rolling on this book. It really struck me. And what it speaks to is the incredible perceptiveness that animals have. In this particular study, which was done in Sweden, The chickens were presented with digitized faces of humans. And by digitizing faces, you can manipulate them and take the average. And studies have found that average faces, quote-unquote average, and I don't mean average in the qualitative sense, I mean where you take the mean of the various variations, tend to be more attractive to us. They're more symmetrical, for instance. And in a nutshell, what they did was they presented these range of faces to undergraduate students, and the students rated them for attractiveness. And then they presented them to the chickens, and the chickens rated them for attractiveness. And they can do that by pecking different buttons to show their choice. And lo and behold, it was an astonishing overlap and similarity in their ratings of preference for faces, about 99% similarity.
So chickens are drawn to the same human faces that humans are drawn to in terms of attractiveness.
According to this study, and it doesn't necessarily mean they find that face necessarily more attractive, but they are able to cue into the same sorts of cues that humans are cueing into.
So what does that tell us?
To me, it tells us that chickens have a lot more going on between their ears than we give them credit for. They're very acutely tuned into their environments. And this is a major theme of my book, Second Nature, is this idea of sentience. And sentience is a term that a lot of people don't know. And it's a term that I hope will become in popular lingo because it's a very, very important term for morality and ethics. Because sentience is the capacity to feel things, pleasures, pains, emotions. And there's a revolution in science going on, and that revolution is that science is taking an interest in animal sentience. There's a new book that just came out this very week alongside of mine called Do Fish Feel Pain? The notion of asking the question, do fish feel pain, would have been laughed at just 40 years ago. And now we have edited volumes on fish cognition and behavior, and we have a new book on fish pain. And by the way, the author who's done this book, she's at Penn State University and an expert in fish physiology and behavior. She concludes quite clearly that they do. And we should expect that to be the conclusion because fishes are mobile organisms. They move around. They can move away from bad things and towards good things. And they have a nervous system and they have a sensory system. So pain, the capacity to avoid things, bad things, is very adaptive for them.
Well, you mentioned sentience, and not to sound like too much of a dweeb, but as a fan of Star Trek, sentience is often a debate about robots when robots achieve sentience, and then you have to treat them in a different way in the sci-fi world. Now, does that have the same implications, do you think, when we talk about animals?
It has the same implications. It has enormous implications. Sentience is the bedrock of ethics. Why is it important to treat others with respect or to treat another well? Well, because they can have days that go well or ill. They can feel things. They can experience things. They can have bad things happen to them, and they can seek out good things. Well, the same goes for non-human animals. We have to come to grips with this. And when I say animals, I'm not talking about necessarily amoebas. We may argue about cockroaches. But if you talk about chickens and giraffes and hyenas and iguana lizards and fishes, we're talking about animals who have a sensory system. And there's no clear evidence that a mouse's pain is any less acute than ours, any less exquisite. In fact, this is not a new idea. Let me just quote from a couple of people from a couple of centuries ago, a British cleric named Humphrey Primmett. In typical 18th century language, he said, "Superiority of rank or station exempts no creature from the sensibility of pain, nor does inferiority render the feelings thereof the less exquisite." Now, that's a rather flowery way of saying what John Webster, a British biologist, said more recently, a little less tactfully. He said, "People, quote, people have assumed intelligence is linked to the ability to suffer, and that because animals have smaller brains, they suffer less than humans. That is a pathetic piece of logic."
So,
quote.
In your view, if fish feel pain, does that mean we shouldn't fish?
Well, you know, that's where you get into where the rubber meets the road. And personally, I would love it if we stopped hauling out fishes out of the oceans the way we do in the numbers of tens of billions a year. And I also get a bad chill when I see someone hauling a fish out on a hook and then dropping it in a bucket and this sort of thing. And of course, I would intervene in that and trying to change that situation, because I relate to the fish. I relate to the fish's experience. This is an exercise of empathy, which, by the way, is another emotion that is being found in other animals. So yes, I would like to see us stop hauling fish out of the ocean. I'm a vegan, and I'm a vegan for ethical reasons. I refuse to eat animal products because I can nourish myself and enjoy my food without causing suffering to other animals.
Well, what about the implications for having pets? Do you think people should or shouldn't have pets?
Well, I'm okay with it. Companion animals or pets, whatever you want to call them, you know, they enrich our lives, but I think we can enrich their lives as well. And I know there are some purists who may say that we shouldn't do that. It's exploitative. But when I think about my two cats, Micah and Megan, I must say they exploit me in certain ways as well. You know, I'm trying to eat my breakfast and Megan wants to chase the ball across the kitchen and she's meowing at me or wants a belly rub. And, you know, it's a beautiful synergy because I get a lot of rewards by interacting with my cats. And I, as an animal behaviorist, I learn a lot about animal behavior. So you could say there's exploitation bidirectional, but it's also mutually rewarding as well.
We're talking to Jonathan Balcom. He's the author of Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to go to the phones and take some of your calls. You can also send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Jonathan Balcom, talking about his new book. It's out, official publication date today. The book is called Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. Now, we've put up on our newly designed website at www.drshow.org a picture from your book cover, from the back flap of your book, of Jonathan Balcom. And on your shoulder is a white rat. Who is the rat?
Her name was Lucy, and she was one of three rats I had while I was living for a couple of years in England.
Now, I think a lot of people have a sort of aversion to rats. Is that fair?
It's a fair statement. Whether they should have an aversion is a whole other thing. And my opinion is that rats have had a bad rap over the years. You know, we have a long history with them, and it's a history that's been a bit troubled. But rats are wonderful companion animals. They're like dogs or cats in a different guise, but they have individual personalities. Studies find that rats are mirthful, that they have these 22 kilohertz chirps high-frequency chirps above our level of hearing that they make when they're tickled. They will come to the hand to be petted, but they will come running to the hand to be tickled, and they will make a lot of these calls. So, and this is studies by an American physiologist. This is top-level science, and so they and the areas of their brain that are active when they make these sounds are the same areas that they that are active when they're an area of the brain that are the same area of our brains that are active when we're laughing. So this guy's actually suggesting that they are experiencing something akin to what we call laughter in ourselves. So there's a lot more to rats than meets the eye. Unfortunately, you know, part of our modern relationship with rats is that we use them a lot in harmful experiments. This is another area that really deeply troubles me and a lot of people who defend animals. The Animal Welfare Act was designed to try and protect animals in research, and yet the percentage of animals actually protected, used in research, that are protected by that act is about 1%. And that's because the rats, mice, and birds are not defined as animals under the Animal Welfare Act. And guess which animals are used 99% of the time?
Now, I think some researchers would argue that by using animals for research, it helps Americans, it helps not just Americans, it helps humans, it helps in the research against diseases. How does that argue? Does that argument sit with you?
Well, you know, one can argue that that issue on alternatives and on the science, and there's certainly a lot of criticism that can be levied at animal research based on the scientific difficulty of extrapolating from a human, from a non-human to a human. But I want to present the ethical argument. You know, we can learn a lot by doing experiments on humans as well. And while we do ethically designed studies using humans, we don't deliberately harm humans in experiments without consent, and even then, it's very carefully planned out. So, you know, my argument gets back to the sentience that these animals have. If their sentience is akin to ours, well, then we need to respect them in a similar way. We don't need to provide homes, perhaps, for rats, although we shouldn't take their homes, their natural homes, away. But when we start to cause them pain and suffering and death, as we do routinely in laboratory experiments, I feel that's a violation of ethics because they're highly sentient animals. They can suffer like we can, and we need to respect that.
You are an ethologist.
That's right.
What is that?
Ethology is the study of animal behavior.
And what kind of, tell us a little about your academic background.
I grew up in Canada. I was born in England, but grew up in Canada and studied biology as an undergraduate in Toronto and got a master's degree in Ottawa. And then I came to the United States back in the late 80s to do a PhD at the University of Tennessee. And I studied communication in bats. I was drawn to bats partly because they're another animal, a bit like the rat or the snake or the spider, which is an animal that's you know, got a bit of a negative image. And so often that's based on ignorance. It's based on a misunderstanding of what bats are. So I studied these charming bats called Mexican free-tailed bats. I've handled probably over 1,000 of them, and they're just really sweet animals with wrinkled faces. But they're also fascinating for their communication system, and they've evolved these huge maternity colonies where mothers have one baby, and they deposit their baby in a limestone cave where there's up to 10 million other babies. And I mean, we're talking 5,000 babies per square yard. That's how densely these animals are packed on these cave surfaces. How on earth does a mother find her baby several times a day to nurse, because they feed milk to their young? These are mammals. How does she find that baby in that densely packed, noisy, completely pitch dark, 24/7? And I will add, a very ammonia intense air. You have to wear a respirator when you go in there. How does she find her baby in that situation? And she studies, intricate studies have found that they use a combination of spatial memory, vocal recognition, which is what I did my dissertation on, and then when they find the pup that is presumably their own, they sniff the pup and they check to see from a scent recognition that that's their own pup, and then they nurse her.
So in part, they recognize the sound that their particular pup makes.
It's a little bit like us you know, being blindfolded and put in our house, and you have to go and find your toothbrush in the upstairs cabinet. You would do it. You'd probably knock a few things over. We're a bit clumsier than these bats are in their caves. But you would do it. But of course, you'd be using two senses to do that, spatial memory and a touch. And the bats are using spatial memory, definitely, but also their acoustic recognition, as you said, and they're also their scent recognition. So it's a suite of sensory cues that they're relying on. Their little brains are very good at doing what they need to do.
So you describe these bats as kind of in very endearing way, and yet I think a lot of people find them kind of terrifying. Why is that?
Again, it gets back to not understanding bats well enough, you know, and it's we don't have classes where people are taught about bats in our schools, although I've gone to a lot of classrooms and spoken about bats. It's a matter of education, and so much of our misunderstanding and mistreatment of animals is founded on ignorance and founded on simply not having the information. And so, bats are fantastic animals. They're beautiful products of evolution. All animals are. And by the way, they're not perfect products of evolution. No species is. Nature is a dynamic process. It's always changing, and it relies on diversity and variability. But bats, they're incredibly diverse, too. They're one in four mammals, if you line them up, every fourth one would be a bat. There's over 1,000 species.
That's a lot of bats. Let's go to the phone lines and let our listeners join our conversation. We're going to go first to Mary. She's calling us from Bluemont, Virginia. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I don't know where to start. I had a little bat visiting last summer, and he came back under my eaves to the same place every day until one day he didn't.
And did you find this alarming or nice?
Oh, it was very sorrowful. I loved having him. He was just less than an inch big, and he nestled there. That wasn't why I called originally. I found Dr. Balcom's comments about chickens especially engaging. I grew up in Scarsdale, New York, where we didn't have a whole lot of chickens, and had to learn sort of without books about keeping mine. And I'm having a problem because Al, who has been my faithful rooster for almost 5 years, seems to have been a little weakened by the storms this winter. And his son, Zeus, who was born around the time of the Olympics, is fighting him off now, creating a terrible scene where he has Al running for, dear life. And last night I tried to keep Al in the run while everybody went to bed in the chicken roost. And he actually knocked down the door to be where he's, where I found blood yesterday. I mean, in the when I woke everybody up in the morning, where they woke me. So I wonder, what's to be done about a son taking over from his dad?
Well, Mary, thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, thanks, Mary, for calling in. This gets back to the imperfection of animals. They have emotions. They discriminate among individuals sometimes, and they're not always nice to each other. And you're going to have to do what you can, and maybe consult some chicken experts. I can't claim to be a chicken expert. I do go to an animal sanctuary near where I live in Potomac. In Maryland, on the Potomac River, a beautiful sanctuary, and I've learned a lot about chickens there, and the people who run that sanctuary know a lot about chickens, but you might have to separate them for a while, but anyway, talk to somebody who lives with chickens and knows their behavior. Incidentally, I mean, chickens, these are the most exploited, abused animals of all on Earth. It's estimated that 10 billion chickens a year are killed in the United States. In the time Mary asked her question, probably about 30,000 chickens were killed to be eaten in the United States. So this is an animal that if we learn about them, we see that they have complex, rich lives, lives that I would say have intrinsic value, lives worth living for them. And yet, unfortunately, we disregard that. And that gets to personal choices about what we choose to buy at the supermarket, for instance, and we can get into more of that later if you like.
Well, I know that you mentioned already that you're a vegan yourself, which means that you don't eat meat or fish or dairy products?
That's right. I mean, veganism is really a lifestyle. It's where one strives to minimize one's negative impact on animals. I mean, one can't avoid harming animals when you get in a car. When you go walking, you might step on something. But it's an attempt to minimize that. And so it goes beyond diet to things, what one buys at the clothing store or what one buys in the drugstore. But yes, as a vegan, I choose to drink soy milk or rice milk instead of cow's milk. And I choose to not buy eggs or cheese. I have as good a palate as anyone, and I love to cook, and I love to bake, and I love food. And I didn't stop eating animal products for gustatory reasons. I did it because of ethical reasons. And there's many ways. Certainly in our society, we have a lot of choices.
And what about, say, leather shoes? Would you choose not to buy leather shoes?
Yeah, the belt and the shoes I'm wearing are non-leather, and a growing number of companies are meeting the needs of those who shop with conscience in this way. And so, one can get those sorts of products.
Well, what do you think about people who are not vegetarians, who eat steak, chicken, duck?
Well, I mean, they're humans like me, and we're all fallible, and that's something that can be changed, that particular behavior. I mean, it's a behavior we all need to come to grips with. You know, I argue primarily on ethics, but, you know, if you're worried about global warming, well, meat consumption is a huge contributor to that. The Nobel Prize-winning report that came out a couple of years ago found that animal agriculture contributes considerably more than does the entire transportation sector to global warming and greenhouse gas emissions. So it's not how you get to the supermarket that's most important. It's what you buy at the supermarket.
Let's go to Miami Beach, Florida, and talk to Antonio. Antonio, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to know about the idea of sentience. Are plants sentient?
Are plants sentient? My response to that would be, from as far as we can tell, no, they are not. And that is simply because they don't have nervous systems. They don't have they're not motile organisms. They didn't evolve as organisms that could move away from things. They can orient differently, and they'll orient towards the sun. But another note I want to say to that question is, as a vegan sometimes, or even a vegetarian, I'm asked this. And in fact, a veterinarian at a vet school in India where I was giving a lecture stood up at the end. He said, "Dr. Balcom, that was a very engaging talk. Thank you. I am a vegetarian," he said, as many Indians are. He said, "But if the whole world were vegetarian, how would we ever grow enough plants to sustain them?" And it was remarkable from a pretty educated fellow that he wasn't aware of the fallacy contained in that question, which is that when we eat higher up on the food chain, which is to say meat, we're actually killing and consuming far more plants than if we eat plants directly. The average Indian eats about 200 kilograms of grain per year, whereas the average American consumes indirectly about four times that amount. Why? Because we're eating grains that are being fed to cattle and other animals.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to David. He's calling us from Little Rock, Arkansas. David, you're on The Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. You know, I grew up on a farm and in a pretty conservative background, and went on to college, got a degree in zoology, and I think I have a fairly, you know, broad spectrum of understanding of animals. And I grew up hunting, and early on recognized that animals, you know, kind of have, I wouldn't necessarily say rights like a lot of people would, but being the smart one in the woods, I understand that animals do suffer, but their populations, especially with deer, have to be controlled. And I don't use animals for target practice, but I do try to euthanize game as humanely as possible, with as little suffering. I don't take chance shots. I don't, you know, just have fun pot-shotting the animals, but I always feel bad when I kill them, and then I love to eat them, as a lot of people do. You know, I've grown to appreciate animals a whole lot more, and I've become very selective in which animals I do hunt. For example, I don't hunt ducks anymore because there's not enough of them. And the last time I killed a duck, it was a pair of wood ducks and one of a pair, and the other duck immediately lighted in a tree nearby and just cried for I don't know how long. So I said, "Oh, there goes my duck hunting career." And recently, or I guess a couple of years ago, I was deer hunting, and I have some land where I deer hunt. There's always a huge flock of turkeys on it. And this one time I was sitting there just peacefully minding my own business in the woods, and this turkey flew into the tree about 50 feet over my head. And then I saw three other turkeys fly up into trees in a sort of a rough circumference of about an acre or so. And they were talking to each other, just very, not like, you know, gobble, gobble, chirp, chirp, all that stuff. They're using very guttural language with inflection and talking back and forth, and they all gave out little calls, and then pretty soon the whole flock came up, and they did this little I don't know, sort of a dance thing, taking turns while rows of them stood and watched. And I said, "Well, there goes my turkey hunting career." Although I've never hunted turkeys, I could just never bring myself to kill one because I always felt like they were too intelligent and they really missed each other when they were killed. But you know, animals are pretty cruel to each other, and I try to be the least cruel predator in the woods. I try to be considerate of my game and not play cat and mouse with them.
David, such an interesting perspective. Thanks so much for calling us. What do you think, Jonathan Balcom?
Well, David said a great deal there, covered a lot of terrain, so let me just respond to a couple of things. First, you know, he talks about hearing the turkeys chattering, and you know, this is there's been other studies of other birds that find that, you know, we're just finally getting close up to them. Now that we have technology where we can actually have little microphones on them and we can film them very close up, we're finding there's a whole other world of communication going on there. And David clearly is quite a good observer of animals, because he noted that and he remembered that. And this is indicative of the problem with our lives with animals. We're often not close to them. We don't get close enough to realize just what's going on. And then there's the inconsistency we have in our relationship to them. I mean, the turkeys that end up on the Thanksgiving plates, and we're talking tens of millions of them, those turkeys are essentially the same animal. I mean, they've been bred for generations to gain weight very quickly. Their toes are cut off, and because they're kept in terrible situations, very crowded situations, and this sort of thing. But essentially that animal, cognitively and emotionally, is a turkey. It's the same animal. It has all the capacity for those sorts of communications. And yet we categorize. Humans are very good at categorizing them. We put them into different categories. This turkey is one who I will not shoot with my gun. He's up perching and talking to his friends in the wild, and I respect that. And then we have other turkeys who we find in the supermarket that are being conveniently plucked by someone else, and we look at that animal as if it's a completely different thing, and in fact it's the same.
David also made the point that he's a hunter, enjoys hunting. He said with an animal like deer, you need to reduce the population. What would be your reaction to that?
Well, I do talk at some length about population in my book Second Nature, and I'm really focusing on the human population, which is now about 6.5 billion. And you know, we talk about controlling populations. We need to look back at ourselves. We're not controlling our own population very well.
Jonathan Balcom is talking about his new book, Second Nature: The Inner Lives of Animals. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones and we'll read some of your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Emily and Antoine von Ochtmal, supporting New Futures, a D.C.-based organization committed to transforming lives through learning, by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Lewis, the author of Liar's Poker, Moneyball, and The Blind Side, talks about his new book, The Big Short. It's about the people who made a fortune when the financial system collapsed because they bet against subprime mortgage derivatives and the financial institutions that sold them. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio, Jonathan Balcom. He's written a new book, Second Nature. He's also the author of a previous book called Pleasurable Kingdom. Now, we've gotten a lot of questions along this line, a lot of emails. Question, what do you feed your cats?
Oh, yeah, great one. Here I am, a vegan. My cats aren't vegan. And I know those who strive to feed their cats a vegan diet, and good on them. I've tried it. Currently, I feed them with conventional food. Now, I will say I live with two other humans, and they, you know, they draw their line a little differently than I do. So it is a compromise. I actually would rather have rats than cats, because rats are omnivores, and you can feed them just about anything, any leftovers, and I much prefer to do that.
So what do you feed your cats?
Oh, they get canned and dry cat food. It's not vegan food.
You know, here's another question along the lines of being a vegan. This emailer writes, "Your guest is a vegan because other animals can feel pain, but the nature of nature is that the strong survive. The lion doesn't play with the lamb. He eats the lamb and thinks nothing of it. While his justification might be enough for him, to me it's just because something can feel pain doesn't mean I shouldn't be allowed to eat them." What about the example of the lion?
I think the key here is the word choice. Humans have a choice in what we eat. I'm not saying we didn't evolve. We evolved as vegans. We evolved as omnivores. But nowadays, when we go and buy meat, people are supporting factory farming, which is just a read the book Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. If you have any doubts about the problems with the way we raise our meat, 95%, 99% of our meat. So I choose. Humans have a choice. We have that benefit of being able to choose what we eat. I'm not telling a lion what a lion should eat, and I have no problem with lions eating the way they eat, where they've evolved to eat. But I have a choice, and I'd like to exercise that choice.
And just one more question along these lines. Mary in Granville, Michigan, sends us an email that says, "I am trying to envision a world where all the animals live without control, such as chickens, rabbits, deer, etc. What would we do with all the eggs that chickens lay? Should they just be dumped? Where would the chickens roost? Human beings are the caretakers of the earth. We need to be responsible, but we need to be realist. Also, what would you say to Mary?
Humans are the caretakers, but we're also the producers of all those animals. The reason those animals are produced in huge numbers is that people are profiting from preparing them, because people will buy them, and that industry gets sustained. So this is a common question to those who choose not to eat animals, is what would we do if we stopped eating them? We would be overrun with them. And indeed, there would be a lot of animals for a short time who were going to survive, who would otherwise be killed. But the reality is that those animals are coming from the breeding machine that's producing them for the animal products that we consume. If we stop eating them, the impetus for those in business to produce the animals is going to go away, and we won't be overrun with them because we won't be breeding them.
All right, let's talk to Kurt. He's calling us from southwestern Ohio. He's been holding on for most of the hour. Kurt, thanks for holding on.
Oh, thank you. I practice a traditional Native American spirituality, and within that, you know, we find life and spirit within everything. And you know, my concern is that we're not looking at plants, probably because we're unable to communicate in the same way as we do with animals. And you know, being a vegan is nice, but in many ways, at least to me, it's no less cruel than taking the life of an animal.
And so, Kurt,
what do
you eat? What kind of diet do you have?
I go all directions. But for me, when I take food, I give an offering back. You just show my respect. If I take a deer, I leave something for it. I try to explain to that deer why I need it. And I do the same for my gardens. When I go to get my corn or my beans, because there's no difference between the spirit spirit of life in an animal as there is in the plants.
And Kurt, you mentioned that you are trying to practice Native American beliefs along this front. Are you yourself a Native American, or is this something you've adopted?
Primarily adopted, but it came from my mother's side of the family.
All right, Kurt, thanks so much for your call.
Kurt, thanks for calling. I'm all for reverence for life. This is a concept that Albert Schweitzer came up with in the early part of the 20th century. And I don't want to hurt plants either, or harm plants. We may argue as whether we can hurt a plant in the physical pain sense. But as I said earlier, I mean, one of the ways I and other vegetarians and vegans exercise reverence for life is to respect all life by consuming as little living organisms as possible. And to reiterate, the vegan diet does that, because not only does one spare animals and animals from producing products to eat, but also we spare a lot more plants, because to eat meat, you've got to feed the animal who with the plants to get the meat. And so, you consume a lot more. One consumes a lot more plants indirectly by eating meat.
You write about something called the mirror test. Tell us what that is.
The mirror test is a test of awareness. It's a test of self-recognition. And mirror self-recognition is one quite clever method that was devised around 1970 by an American biologist to do that. What was done was the animals were, in this particular case, I think they were anesthetized chimpanzees, and a dot was put on their forehead, a part of the body that they cannot see themselves unless they see it in a mirror. And then you present the animal with a mirror, and The litmus test is if the animal seeing his or her reflection in the mirror, instead of, say, looking behind the mirror or something else or making a weird face or whatever, acting aggressively, actually immediately touches the dot. And in fact, chimpanzees will not necessarily do that right away because they're not used to a mirror. They will show some puzzlement, but then they will usually quickly realize that what they're seeing is themselves or who they're seeing is themselves. And it's been since shown that elephants, dolphins, and just a couple of years ago, magpies, a bird, will pass the mirror self-recognition test. Just one more point on that, though. Failure at mirror self-recognition shouldn't be an indication of lack of self-awareness. Animals in the wild don't typically encounter mirrors, so we shouldn't expect they necessarily will respond appropriately to them.
You have, how do you test to see whether a magpie can pass a mirror test?
It was done by putting different colored dots on their bibs. Magpies have sort of black heads and necks. And so if you put a yellow dot on there, and then these are animals used to being in a captive situation, and then they see their reflection, these magpies, if they had a yellow dot, they would immediately scratch it with their foot or use their bill. If they put a black dot on the black bib, which is a control experiment, the animals wouldn't do that. Presumably, they just simply couldn't see it there. Even though it was there, they couldn't see it.
You talk about theory of mind as being important. What is theory of mind?
Theory of mind really is awareness that another has a mind as well. And, I can give one example here that I think is an example of the elegant sorts of experiments being done on animals nowadays. And when I say experiments, I mean investigations into how they function, what sort of emotions they have, or what sort of cognition. And incidentally, animal cognition is a relatively new thing. It was shunned for much of the 20th century, and now there's even a journal called Animal Cognition. Well, rats show metacognition, that is, they are aware of their own knowledge. So it's sort of a form of this awareness, but it's a form of self-awareness. And the way that's tested is to give them a different reward system. If they have a choice between two cues, let's say we're talking about two tones, and I'll make this very quick. Let's say a long tone and a short tone. Beep and beep, very easy to tell apart. The rat will quickly vote which one was the longer tone and push a lever to indicate that and gets a big reward. However, if you present them with two tones that are very similar in length, such as beep and beep, then they have a third choice. They can put their nose in a cone and vote to go to the next trial. They get a tiny reward for that, but it's better than getting nothing. So this is an elegant way of showing that, and rats will do that. They will not push either long or short lever. They will vote to go to the next trial. It's a way of showing that they know what they know and they know what they don't know, and they know what they're confident in.
Here's an email from Jeff, who writes us from Washington, D.C. He says, "The main thing that distinguishes humans from other animals is our ability to hallucinate, to imagine, to fantasize, and thus to worry about things that haven't happened yet, or to keep remembering something troubling from the past." Now, that's something humans certainly do. Do other animals do that?
I don't know, and it's an example of an exercise that we humans feel the need to do. We may become a bit defensive or threatened if we feel like animals are being presented as like us. And it's really not my goal to say that animals are like humans, but animals are complex and sentient in their own ways, and we continue to try and raise the bar. I mean, the 20th century has shown a growing list of things that animals are capable of that we used to think were just the province of humans. Can animals hallucinate? I don't know, but in Pleasurable Kingdom, I do talk about how lemurs and some other monkeys will mouth these large millipedes. They'll pick them up if they find them, and they'll sort of harass them for a while. And the millipedes release these harsh chemicals, defensive chemicals. And the lemurs seem to know that, and they become drooly and floppy, and they get kind of a high. And apparently, they even pass them around among the group. So rather reminiscent of certain behavior we may have in human society. So, you know, the closer we look, the more we find animals do things that we used to think that they did.
How about being deceptive, lying? Do animals do that?
There's a great deal of deception in nature. I mentioned earlier the chicken come hither call, where the hen comes running. But sometimes roosters, just as an example, will make the come hither call when the rooster knows there's nothing there. Studies show that they will not do this if hens are very nearby, because presumably they know they might be detected as lying. But if the hen's far enough away, the hen will come running, the rooster points it out, and then she finds nothing. Well, grasshoppers can jump away, so it may be a way of getting some credit on the cheap, if you like. However, hens are equally perceptive, and they will soon identify an inveterate cheater, an inveterate deceiver, and they will shun him. One other point I want to make on deception is deception only works in populations if people are honest, if individuals are honest most of the time. So deception really relies on virtue.
Are there some animals that are so consistently deceptive that there's no element of trust among them?
There are probably individuals who are consistently deceptive, but no. I mean, it's not like there's a species where just about everybody deceives, again, because deception isn't going to work. Everybody's going to ignore everyone else when they do something, because if everybody's deceiving, that's why deception is always, by definition, it's a low-frequency behavior. It doesn't work unless most individuals are honest most of the time.
Well, talk about whether animals make moral choices, including moral choices that might be against their personal self-interest.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of examples of what's called altruism in nature, and there's a number of theories as to why that be. It may have evolved kin selection and reciprocal altruism and this sort of thing. But there are many examples of animals who will pay a self-sacrifice, sacrifice themselves for the good of others. And I mentioned alarm calling earlier as an example of that. Studies where chimpanzees or rats, for that matter, if a rat is presented with another rat who's in distress, the rat will act to remove that rat from distress, even if the rat doesn't know the other rat. Chimpanzees and other animals have been presented with people who are trying to pick something up and they're struggling. The chimpanzee will go over and help the human. And this is without reward. They're not given a reward for that. It's as if doing good is rewarding in itself. And again, it gets back to being social, particularly for social animals. Doing good is a smart move. And I don't want to make this sound just selfish, because there's a lot of examples that show it's not just selfish. But by doing good, you buy some credit. You know, it's why we like to give flowers to people when it's their birthday or when they're ill. It makes us part of society, and it helps to lubricate society and makes us feel good about ourselves.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. We'll go to Hearst, Texas, and talk to Mark. Mark, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, and thank you for an excellent guest. I'm actually kind of an animal rights activist in my spare time. And my question is, how do I convince people or help convince people in literally that 20-second blurb on the sidewalk when we're handing out things at a circus, for example, or at a demo where we're handing out vegan flyers and so forth? Is there just kind of a quick summary to get people to think a little bit deeper on the subject? Because, frankly, the most cruel thing that most people do on any given day is three times a day they'll sit down and eat murdered animals.
All right, Mark, thanks for your call.
Thanks, Mark. I mean, I support what you're doing. It's great that you're out on the street, because people just simply need to be made aware of the choices they make and the role they can play in helping animals. I don't have a quick 20-second one. I mean, you know, we could work on that. You can email me. We can come up with the best one we can. But I'm sure you have some good things you can say. But definitely, I would touch on the individual's role. And I don't have the quote in front of me, but what was her name? I can't think of her name right now. She said something about, you know, isn't it wonderful that right now we can immediately start to make a difference in the world? I find that very empowering. And Frank, by the way, is who I was trying to think of.
Here's a question from Facebook. Joe writes us, can you ask your guest to comment on the claims about dolphins that were made by the filmmakers in The Cove, which just won an Oscar for Best Documentary? It's really an amazing story, Joe writes.
I'm wishing I'd seen The Cove. I didn't see The Cove. I was delighted to see it won an Oscar. I didn't see The Cove because I've seen enough footage of dolphins being slaughtered in this area, this cove in Japan, where it happens every year, and it's just a horrendous thing. But I'm sorry. What was the question again?
Just to your comments on the claims about dolphins that were made by the filmmakers.
Yeah, I guess that what they're claiming is that dolphins are highly sentient. I mean, that should not be controversial. Dolphins are sentient. They have a sophisticated communication. They actually have names for each other. They have signature whistles that they identify themselves, but others refer to them that way. So it's quite analogous to our use of names.
You write in your book about Kelly the dolphin. Tell us about Kelly.
Yeah, Kelly. I mean, talk about deception or incognition in an animal. Kelly the dolphin. This is an anecdote. I present a lot of science in my book, but people love stories as well, and stories can be very telling about what animals are capable of. And Kelly was a captive dolphin. And by the way, this is not advocacy for captive dolphins. I would like to see the aquariums emptied. Dolphins don't belong in these aquariums, these houses of mirrors for them. Anyway, Kelly was trained in various ways, and if Kelly misbehaved and didn't do what she was supposed to do, which dolphins will often do. They have their own will. The trainer, way to signal that Kelly was being bad, was to stand stock still away from the aquarium. And then one day, Kelly was being fed food that Kelly doesn't particularly like, and Kelly immediately swam to the far end of the aquarium and swam vertically and stayed vertically very still that way. It was sort of Kelly had adopted the signal that the trainer used to say that this is bad behavior, you need to change your behavior.
Jonathan Balcom, he's written a new book. It's called Second Nature, The Inner Lives of Animals. And he's joined us this hour in the Diane Rehm Show. He was reminding me during the break that he was a caller to the Diane Rehm Show about 10 years ago when we had a show about frogs and he got on the air. So he's a longtime fan of the show. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.